I'm still drinking from the fire. Yeah, yeah, I'm still trying to find this. Find out where the elevator is and all of those things. But moving along, my past history was all large bond programs over the last 20 or so years. Just got back from Saudi Arabia, is working a $100 billion bond program and an $18 billion bond program. Prior to that, I worked for Los Angeles Unified School District for 6 years. I was the director of new construction there on the $28 billion bond program. And I'm happy to be back in the public sector, working with all of you folks and doing well and building the learning environment. And any questions you have of me, feel free to ask.
So, Jim, some of them don't know who you are as far as you. Jim is the new executive director of the Facilities Planning Development for the district. So those of you that haven't heard his name.
What is his name, I think?
Jim O'Reilly.
Oh, Jim O'Reilly.
Yeah. Here, I'll point this way.
He's here on item number one on the agenda.
So it was an introduction of Jim for item number one.
One question of Jim. What is the thing that actually was closest that you have done?
There should be an agenda.
LAUSD is closest. It's in LA. The players are all the same.
Should have like a paper.
We have many of the same challenges that we run into. I would say that would probably be the closest. This is not like Saudi, thank goodness.
I noticed you're something.
Yeah, I'm glad to be back.
In terms of size, though, I'm curious. I assume LA Unified School District is larger, but I have no basis for saying
that. Yeah, it's about four or five times the size of this particular bond measure. But I only manage the new construction. So while it was a $28 billion bond measure, I managed about $18 billion of it. So it was probably about three times the size of this particular one. And then the one in Saudi was just, as far as I know, that's going to be the largest program ever in the history of the world. It was $100 billion. We were building 11 cities, entire cities, infrastructure, housing, et cetera. They're doing a very good job of trying to keep the Arab Spring in check in Saudi right now. But doing a lot of social programs and spending a lot of money.
Okay, thank you. Nancy, let us know when you're ready.
You're pitching for another 5 minutes.
Okay.
At least.
Do we have any public speakers at this meeting? Members of the public who choose to address the District Oversight Committee? Okay. You might have been beginning with the financial audit. Those who are here to address the financial audit.
Absolutely.
And remind us what materials we should have to track you.
Okay. You have a presentation from us that looks like this. You have a staple packet that looks like this. This is the audit reports for each of the audits. And that's what we'll be going over now. You'll have that?
This one.
I know. But I had color before and I got in trouble for that. So we're black and white, two-sided, so I'm sorry they all look alike.
Recycle paper.
Way to be green.
And plant this in your backyard and it's sure to grow a tree. Right?
Whatever you'd like to do with it at the end of the meeting. Okay. Just a quick introduction. My name is Mark Tillotson. I'm here with Chris Ray. We both have been involved in the audit at the district on the financial statement level as well as the bond expenditures. What we're presenting to you today is the audit report on the bond construction programs, Prop A, Prop AA, and Measure J. What you have before you is the full audit reports for each of those. It's the statement of expenditures on bond proceeds that we bring to you for approval. Both the independent auditor's report on each of those reports is an unqualified opinion, which is as good as it gets, a clean opinion. We also issue in this packet for each of the bond measures a report in accordance with government auditing standards. And we've got in that report, we list out exactly where we may or may not have deficiencies in internal control. deficiencies exist when the design or operation of a control does not allow management or employees in the normal course of performing their assigned functions to prevent or detect and correct misstatements in the financial statements on a timely basis. So this broad definition of a deficiency, then it goes into severity. Deficiency, significant deficiency, and material weakness. And I've got those definitions here.
But it's strictly a financial audit.
This is, yes, an audit of the expenditures of bond proceeds.
Okay.
So not your when you look at it, it's not going to be your traditional financial statements that you're used to seeing, no balance sheet, income statement.
And it's unqualified
because... It's unqualified.
Is there such a thing as a qualified letter?
A qualified would be, yes. A qualified is not good, or not as good, right? It's a qualification would be, we've audited it and we find it to be in compliance except for these items.
So unqualified is
good. An unqualified, believe it or not, is that it doesn't sound...
Well, how does an unqualified differ from your description of a qualified?
We don't have any qualifications on our opinion.
You don't have except for?
Correct. That materially mistake, because what we're giving our opinion is on the schedule of expenditures, and it is fairly stated in all material respects. Okay. So, but that doesn't mean we don't have items that we found. The items that, and we'll go over those right now. So the items that we found did not cause us to alter our opinion in any way. But we do have items.
Just one more question
to bring to your attention.
As we know, several construction contractors have been disqualified in the last year because they did things that were inappropriate financially, they charged incorrectly, and they misstated. Should your audit have found that in the past?
No, I don't believe that to be true.
We have a financial audit.
The scope of our audit, we would look for the expenditures that were claimed, see if they had supporting documentation to support the expenditures, see if they were allowed by the bond measure. Determining whether they were legally allowed to be claimed would not follow the specific reporting.
We have noted in here and in our report deficiencies, and combined we note that the deficiencies noted in each report represent a significant deficiency in internal control, and we've listed them out. They're very similar all the way through, just given the fact that the bonds are very similar in what they're accomplishing. Quickly, just to kind of go over them, we pull a sample, we test on a sample basis, and through that we noted invoices for, let's look at A, Prop A for example. We looked at invoices, and in our sample we noted $11,000 that were not recorded in the proper period. We extrapolate that out, the extrapolation on the sample basis is about $62,000 that potentially could be reported in the wrong period. If you look at your schedule, it's broken off into the current year and then all other periods. So $62,000 potentially could be in the wrong period. We noted that the program manager identified some controls during the control deficiencies during the period, which items were caught and corrected, and we bring those to your attention as well. The second one is where they've been scrubbing the color of money, basically, and I'm sure you've heard that term, but what bond pays for which project? Is it allowed under A or AA or J? And we noted that there was a net reclassification between the bond measures of $600,000 related to A. One of our items that we've had on our report is the reconciliation of furniture, fixtures, and equipment. And in our report, we talked through what our finding, our recommendation, and the corrective action from management. So you can read that as they continue to put together systems and controls to monitor and track furniture, fixtures, and equipment. The last one was more of a district-wide item that we noted about the reconciliation of information included on the district's Form 700 which identifies vendors and subcontractors and their dealings with the district. So as we go through those, each of those, you'll see the common theme throughout them, because, again, our test work centered around authorization, existence, accuracy, and presentation and completeness of the expenditures recorded in the schedule of expenditures. I'll leave it there if you have any questions.
Well, yeah, I want your evaluation of what you found. On a scale to 1 to 10, where 10 is most serious, how would you grade your findings, not in terms of their accuracy, but in their implications of the financial management of the enterprise?
Well, I think it speaks from our unqualified opinion. If we had severe questions in the integrity of the data, that would have resulted in a modification of our opinion. And what we bring to you are the deficiencies that we noted.
Okay, I can't evaluate what you're saying. I'm asking you something simple that we'll all understand. Mm-hmm. Okay, there were deficiencies. There were always deficiencies in enterprises. Okay, is your opinion that the deficiencies you found, from your professional perspective, how serious are they on the scale of 10 to 1?
Okay, well, if one is just a controlled, if one is no deficiencies, that would be starting. If you have control deficiencies which don't raise to the level of a significant deficiency, that would be somewhere between 3 to 5 in a 10 scale. If you have significant deficiencies, that's somewhere between 5 and 7. And then if you have material weaknesses in your internal controls, that's a 10. Right. So
now,
these are.
Did you give me the number that corresponds to this? 3 to 5?
Yeah.
3 to 5.
So it's in the middle. I mean, it's something that's worth people in charge with governance to be aware of. But it's not doesn't raise to the level of something that's
how,
material.
Thank you.
How unexpected would these to be in a project as huge as this, with as a diverse funding as it is? Or how expected would deficiencies be? You take it from either position.
You're right. I mean, it's a large program, so to have a completely no finding audit would be
unexpected.
I mean, there's human elements involved in this program. It's complex, so there are some exceptions. That's why we take a sample and then we extrapolate the exceptions that we note over the whole population, just to see if the trend of the exceptions we note would be material to the client.
Is part of your contract to recommend corrective procedures to the Board of Trustees?
Yes.
And has that happened?
That has happened.
Oh. And what recommendations did you make? Are they in here?
They're consistent with there. I mean, we actually audit, as Mark indicated, we do both the bond audits as well as the financial statements for the district. So they were sometimes at different levels of recommendations, but they are consistent with what's in this report to related to the controls that are in place, the reconciliations.
So they're in the larger report.
Okay, I'd like to personally request, and others may join me, the larger report with the recommendations you made.
Oh, it's in the...
Sorry.
This is the
larger report. Okay.
Double-sided.
This is the summary here.
Thank you.
Who forgets to
be? It all looks the same, I think.
Thanks.
So I just might mention that this is the 10-11 financial audit.
Right.
Okay, so we're getting started on the 11-12 real quick, and you'll see that before this time next year, because it'll move faster. And you'll also, at the next meeting, you will probably be seeing the performance audit come forward for the 10-11, and that one will move faster next year too.
It's just been recognized that the correction of the deficiencies is on page 12 of the legal report. You just want to make notation for yourselves.
And it's for each one, so you have all three of them in there, and so each measure has its
separate
own
line.
Finding and response as you go through.
Any other questions, concerns? Need for information?
Maybe at the next meeting.
I personally would like to recommend that if you can find time in the next 2 months to read through the materials you've received, and if you have any questions, write yourself questions on the margins and bring them into the next meeting. And I will put it back on the agenda for the next time for discussion. If you think there's some role that we need to take, I would appreciate you doing that very much.
This is going forward.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
If you had opening comments to make.
If I had opening comments, well, I was going to, I believe we have some new members here who haven't met yet. Stuart's not here yet, and the other two, we still have two open positions, Foundation and LACC. So the new one who is coming, Stuart, is not here yet. He is representing.
He will be Foundation.
Foundation,
yeah. But we have to look forward to that.
Well, he hasn't been approved yet, so.
Yes.
He's in process.
Right. He'll come back to board.
I had some notes to myself which have disappeared from my mind. I apologize for being delayed and late. Every once in a while, things fall apart at home. And this was one of those days.
They don't happen very often, to use credit cards.
No, they don't happen very often, but this one did. Jim O'Reilly, who is who I was going to do in my opening things, and I thank you very much for joining with us today.
No, my pleasure.
Being here. And I was asked, although I finished my term and I in September, but I go off as chair at the end of the next meeting, I was asked if I would like to continue on fishing to help do the annual report, because we would like to get it out earlier this time. And since I've been chair during this period, I've agreed to say, yes, I will work on the annual report, so it isn't left to a new chair coming in to do it.
Thank you.
But you're welcome to write the letter to me, or whoever comes in as chair. I don't know who's going to come in as chair. But what I would like is some idea of who would volunteer to help me, because it should not be a single person project. Okay, Elliot. And if anyone else thinks about it, Donna, you have been wonderful for me. Would you be interested?
That's fine.
I don't want to give you work you don't want.
Okay.
I'm going to do an editorial comment that you can throw out or ignore or whatever you want. One of the recommendations that has come down is that we only have one representative from a college sitting on this committee, but for representing all nine colleges. Right now, we have nine representatives. We each bring a different perspective because each of our colleges is a unique entity and things are going on differently. I have some strong feelings about it because the people who are representing business and other things are extremely busy people. And when we ask for people to participate and assume responsibility for doing projects, Slauson is, Richard is come in and he's not from a college, but he's been, fortunately he's retired. But anyway, I don't know what other people's opinion on that. I might put it on the agenda for next time, but I personally feel that we need more than one person representing nine colleges as far as what's going on there that represent their COCs. Other people may not feel that way. They may feel we are useless. But in all reality, I'm being honest. I don't know perspective of other people. I'm seeing it from my perspective. But when I ask for things to come help me do things and whatnot, it is the college reps that say, yes, I'll help you. So if you get rid of all of us.
Will you validate that by agreeing to work on the annual report?
I can do that.
Well, I don't know if a president has time. He's got his answer right now.
I'm trying to understand your editorial remark in terms of college representation.
One of the recommendations from the committee is that there only be one representative representing all nine colleges.
That's people like you. Right now, there are nine.
Well, right now, there's nine. One, two, three, four. I can't see my own. One's nine. And go down to one.
So
I don't
you're
know.
Suggesting maybe
his perspective at West is very different than her perspective from Pierce. And mine from Harbor and Southwest and whatever, and so that was the thing.
Can I help you out here a little?
Yeah.
So on the building program review report, the recommendation was to only have one representative from the colleges, and have instead of the 9 representatives that we have. I think this will be an issue that the
board's going to consider.
The board ad hoc committee will consider. And it's agendized a little bit later in your agenda to talk about the building program review panel report summary that we handed out. So it is there.
It will be revisited then this conversation.
We can talk about it a little bit. It is anyway, one of the recommendations.
Today. If it's all right with this group, I'd like to put it up for some discussion. I mean, I may be out by myself and no one else is going along that trail with me. And that's, I just need to know that, you know, and
I was just going to say, I believe it's on your agenda, item 8.
So down below.
Yeah.
On the review panel. I read the review, but I didn't know if all of you have. Again, that is something all of you should read. Okay, that's about it. Did we do the minutes?
No.
Please look at the minutes, and I would like a motion for correction or approval.
Except we don't have a quorum.
Oh, we don't have a quorum. Okay.
We're missing one person.
Is Donald here? Donald here? Yeah, okay. Ethel, I don't see. Eva is down there at the corner. Bob. Richard's here. James. Terry.
I'm here.
Okay. I'm sorry, some of you are brand new to me. There are 2 open positions. David Rattray.
David couldn't make it.
Okay, Donna's here. Danny Schwartz. Open and down. David Gomez. No. Okay.
I don't wonder if this is an active list because there are several people who have a conflict of interest.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
Open positions
they're
now.
Open.
They're showing as open positions. Okay. And so we need 9 for a quorum. It's difficult to get when we have that many open positions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Do we meet with those open positions?
Those open positions don't count towards quorum.
Yes.
They have been counting them towards quorum.
Yes.
Except, I did double check. The administrative regulation is what's currently in place,
right.
Currently controlled. There is a change in the bylaws to make the number 9 for a quorum.
Right.
However, in the administrative regulation, which still applies, the quorum is 8.
Quorum is 8?
Yes. So we're okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Kevin. If you don't know Kevin works...
I work for Camille. People confuse us all the time.
Well, certainly your accent is different.
You are by far taller than she is.
Yes.
Okay, Kevin, thank you. I thought that the board's thing on our way is over. Overdid the other one because it's now. I think it's the new administrative rate, and 9 is. But we do have to count the open seats. But either way, okay. I'm not comfortable. I think your advice of 8 we can go with. So does anyone have any additions, corrections, or whatnot to the minutes? Yes.
There's just a question on page number 8. But the last meeting, someone made a comment. We're not sure if it was Mr. Anderson or not. It's like the second paragraph on page 8.
And Mr. Question, inquiry is the method which the college are renewed for more form. Yes. I don't know if you made that comment. If anybody recalls making it.
I don't remember who asked you that.
Which one is it?
It's on page 8, the very second little paragraph. And what we can say is one of the members. We can correct it to say if you aren't sure, one of the members.
One of the members. Just say one of the members because I'm not sure if they asked that question.
Okay, a member.
Yeah. Actually, I think it was me.
Okay. Okay, then we will leave you there.
Okay, thank you.
Without the question mark.
Yeah. Take out the question.
Okay.
There is one other correction that I think we need to do, and it's about halfway down on the last big paragraph on that same page.
Mm-hmm.
He stated that this contractor gave the district the option. It's not contractor. This bill gave the district the option.
The bill was sponsored by a major contractor.
The sentence starts with he. Mm-hmm. Stated okay. That this bill.
It should be this bill instead of this contract.
Right.
Okay. Any other corrections, additions, clarifications? May I have a motion to accept the minutes as presented? I mean, as corrected.
So moved.
Second.
Second. Okay. All approved?
Aye.
Anybody against it? Anybody not moved it? All right. What's that? Okay, financial audit. Legal actions. Kevin, are you going to do Camille's report?
She didn't give me anything specific to report, so I can't report on any new cases. She didn't actually tell me there were any.
Did you want to ask about the RFPs, that response that came in related to our thoughts about legal representation?
Did that wind up on the agenda?
No, I'm just putting it under Camille's report, since she had said
at the last meeting, I thought we were going to put that on the agenda to review the issue of whether or not the DCOC was interested in hiring outside legal counsel. And Camille was to provide information on the possibility of sending out RFPs to law firms.
Yes.
And I know that there were some responses, but whether or not you have them or not, if you wanted to report on them.
I can.
I have some copies of them, but
I have one copy.
I have one copy. There's two RFPs yes. That came in.
Yeah. The Office of General Counsel sent out an RFP to replenish our attorney panel. And as part of that, we asked for proposals from counsel that are willing to serve as counsel to the DCLC. We got two responses, one from a firm, Myers Nave, and a second response from a firm, Luna Glushon. So we have the proposals. They're available for interview. I think that's usually the next step if you want to interview them. We just have to consider, we can figure that out after the interviews if you want to go forward with it, but at least there are two firms available.
That are interested. One,
they're interested, and one of the firms, they currently serve as counsel for a DCOC at San Francisco Unified School District.
With only eight voting members here, do you want to go ahead with the discussion of it?
I don't know what we can do without, really it boiled down, I think, to the issues of cost.
It's a big issue.
Along with the issue of independent legal advice. And we'd be rehashing everything we've talked about so far if we did not have the component of the cost involved, so everyone could see what we would be getting into. So I would suggest that it goes on the next agenda again, and that the RFP responses be sent to all of the board members so that they can review it before the next meeting, so that you will see what the cost proposals actually were from these two different firms.
I actually have a question for the legal counsel.
Okay, but let's finish this question first. Then we will send out the RFPs to all of you to take a look at. The
proposals.
Their response to the RFP. The proposal response to the RFP. And then you're on the agenda next time to present something to see where we'll go from that. And hopefully we will have enough members here that we can have a discussion. And
are you expecting to send out any additional RFPs other than those two?
We sent it out to the broad community and also advertised in newspapers and to
other
interest groups.
Was there a deadline?
Yes, it was last Friday.
So we have the ones that came in.
Got all we're going to get.
All we're going to get.
Which was just two.
Well, can we also get the RFP sent with that?
It's pretty long.
Or a summary of it anyway? Or?
I mean, I have a copy of it. I can certainly send it to you electronically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Send it to all, I guess. People can always not look at it if they choose.
Okay. Right. Now, is there any chance that since it's going to be continue over to June, that this could be extended so others might?
Well, no. This was the district. They were putting out RFPs in general for legal support for the district, because a lot of the business of the district is not handled by in-house attorneys.
Yes.
It is handled, sent out. And so this was a broad-based RFP that went out, that this was one part of the broad-based RFP. Mm-hmm. And so it would not be, I don't, at least it's up to you, but I don't know if it would be appropriate to send one out again for this one bid.
Well, like I said, we solicited bids for the DCOC at the same time
right.
that we solicited bids, for example, for litigation counsel to handle discrimination cases or bond cases or construction cases, that sort of thing, also for municipal bond counsel. And so we asked for proposals as part of our larger RFP. And so I can send you that, which was publicly
well, I just want the part that pertains to us here.
Yes. It's it's in here, and I can send you the. Now, Camille sent you the two responses already.
Yes, I have those, but I don't know if she sent it to all of us.
No, I think she just sent it to you.
Is the part that applies to us severable?
Yeah, it's just basically
one paragraph.
I don't
want to rip it out. I mean, can you understand it by itself?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, two other things that came up in the discussion when I was...
Do we conclude then that you were going to send out?
Yes, I'll send it to the two of you, and then you can forward it on.
She'll send it out.
Okay.
Send it
very good. That'll work. I'll send her all three. Okay. Two proposals and the RFP.
Yes, your question.
I actually have a couple of questions. In our last meeting, we stated that we were going into a litigation battle for FTR International. And I also
I have that up on my notes over here.
And
FTR
then,
and GSE. I have two notes that I asked
And then I was also inquiring if the appeals process went through for the Vandy Camps Coalition on their CEQA appeal.
Do you know?
Yeah, with the Vandy Camp Coalition, they have an appeal on two of their cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so they filed the appeal on the first case, which has to do with their challenge to the leases to the city. So there's an issue with the underlying court case, but on the first part of their case, which they lost, they appealed that. Their court ruled against them with respect to the Quattro design contract, where there was additional work for the balcony enclosures. So they're appealing that part. In the meantime, the court issued a judgment and then later withdrew the judgment, believing that, well, because she made a mistake. So the Vandy Camp Coalition is arguing that the court didn't have authority to remove or to void the judgment in the manner that the court did. So they're filing an appeal on that as well.
Oh, messy. Okay.
Okay. The there were two things that I discussed with the chancellor when we were putting the agenda together. One was to update us on the GSE settlement, the Gateway settlement. Can you do that, Kevin, or not?
I wasn't involved. I read the Gateway settlement.
Yeah, I can.
Thank you.
So the board at the last board meeting reached an agreement with Gateway. They will be staying at the campus for now, and there is a monitoring process that's being put in place, and they'll have they're going to pay for a special monitor to oversee some of the stuff out of their proceeds. And there will also be an implementation of a software program that checks on conflicts of interest as part of this. And, of course, you know, we expect them to perform.
I'm sorry, I don't know who Gateway is. What is
GSE? They're a CPM firm that was at Mission College.
Right. So they're back right now?
So they never left.
Oh, they're still there.
Yeah. But they're on restriction now.
They have to make sure that they follow through and meet the requirements that we put on.
Is that expected?
I wouldn't see why they wouldn't want to.
I mean, sometimes you have an idea whether it's going to work or not.
Well, we did a similar thing with Turner at West LA, and we saw that their performance didn't improve to the point where we wanted it, and they're no longer with us. So, you know, I would hope that, you know, given an opportunity to show improvement, that we would see that happen.
John, you met with them this week, correct?
That is correct, yes. That was in relation to the CPM performance review. and the basis of that review and the corrections actions that will be put in place will be used as a measure of their performance moving forward, and we're working with them to get that in place. Yeah.
Thanks for that. The other question I had is an update of FTR appealing a negative ruling. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, FTR is kind of in flux because they have a council that worked with them for 30 years. This guy, Bradley Raisin and Bradley Oku. And they are withdrawing as counsel for FTR on several of the stop notice cases. We have a hearing on May 2nd. So I don't know what that's going to do with their appeal. They did appeal the debarment decision as part of the bigger lawsuit that we have against them regarding the Allied Health and Science Building. The court ruled in their favor, but only for the purpose of having us do a separate mediation where some third party can look at the case. They really didn't prevail, although there's that argument. And I don't think they have not filed an appeal with respect to that. They've won, so at least they won at the first stage. If anyone's going to appeal, it would be us appealing the judge's decision to overturn the debarment.
Okay, is that anything you're
going to
add?
No, I think Kevin's correct there.
Okay. I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question, Kevin. Tracy Traber's firm withdrew? Is that who you said their attorneys?
No, Cavalucci. Brad Raisin is withdrawing. He hasn't withdrawn yet. He's withdrawing from representation on the stop notice cases. So I don't know how far reaching that's going to be, but he is certainly
not
withdrawing.
The other attorney.
I don't know who the other attorney is.
All right.
Yeah.
That was the notes that I had on legal action. Inspector General's report. Are you ready?
I am ready. I have to say, I do look forward to coming here and presenting in front of you.
Thank you. This is Christine, for those of you that know.
Okay, Christine Mara, Inspector General. And Mr. So you should have a copy of the latest audit that we just completed. We performed an audit of how the bond program selects professional service consultants. Professional service consultants for such services as architects or engineers who design the bond projects, landscape architects, whole business commissioning, environmental consultants, surveying, etc. Not construction contractors. So this is primarily how we hire consultants like myself to work on the bond program.
So when you have a build program, design build program, the people who do the design?
Yes, the design. They
are consultants as opposed to the holders of a contract, a specific contract for that effort?
Yes, this excludes the design build construction contracts that include the architect. This excludes that. We did that audit as part of the construction selection. Thank you for mentioning that. The audit objective was to see if there were procedures and policies in place that would encourage a competition or some kind of a procurement of selection process before there was an award of a consulting contract, to ensure that the processes for selection were impartial, and to ensure that the program manager, Build LACCD, and each individual CPM firm were complying with their contractual terms around the selection of these contracts. We tested contracts at each campus for each CPM firm as well as the program manager from 2007 through the beginning of 2011. That was the testing period. I just want to give you some background on what the statutory requirements are for professional services contract, because it needs to be made clear. There is no requirement or mandate that the community college district must have a competitive process. The regulations allow for the district to adopt a policy that would then say you must go through a selection process to get the best value or based on qualifications. Because it's not a mandate, there are no violations found in the audit that we have violated any statutes. So that's the first.
But beyond that, you look at whether or not best practices are employed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we found that the 9 CPM firms, for the most part, adhered to procedures and policies put in place by the original program manager, Dim Jim, from the PMP manual. And that had some an outline of requirements for competition. However, they've been inconsistently followed. And let me give you some specific results that we found. We examined 33 contracts spread over the nine campuses, as well as the program managers' district-wide contracts. We found that 27% of the contracts did not undergo any kind of competitive process at all. They went through a process where they would select from what is called a pre-qualification list that is posted on the website by Build LACCD, and they basically selected one firm to have a contract, but they did not go under a competitive process. In other words, they didn't pick three and then negotiate, etc.
But somebody qualified the firms on that list?
Yes.
And who did that?
I'm sorry?
Who qualified the firms on that list?
The list is basically, you get on the list by submitting a statement of qualifications to Build LACCD. I believe it's preliminarily reviewed, and then if it meets the qualifications of, say, an architect and has the right licenses, it'll go on the website. But it's not what I consider a true pre-qualification process. The design build process goes through an actual RFP, selects people, and then they get on the list. So it's a little bit more, there's a lot more due diligence on that. For the current list they have on the website, it's just that they meet a statement of they submit a statement of qualifications. So 27% did not undergo any competitive process. 36% may have gone through a competitive process, but the documentation was missing or could not be substantiated. 25% went through a competitive process, but there was also some negligible document control deficiencies, so they couldn't be verified. And 12% were contracts that we found that have been extended or given more work from the base contract for that campus. In other words, an example would be a landscape architect given a contract back in, say, 2004, has now performed all the landscape architect projects for all the projects on the campus. They just keep extending their contract. So that's what we're finding. That's what we found. Additionally, there were no material weakness or significant deficiencies found that would violate any procedures or policies. However, we found certain deficiencies that we feel there's room for improvement, such as document controls. Because we found missing documents or no evidence of selection, we feel that the document control by the CPMs was inefficient. They didn't have a conflict of interest management, as we know. We currently have one now, but during the testing period, there wasn't any conflict of interest checks done for the selection process. And lastly, as you mentioned, the pre-qualification list that's on the website, we feel that it hasn't been... it's not what I consider a true pre-qualification list, and that it isn't annually updated or reviewed periodically to ensure that those firms on there still have and still meet those qualifications. And I meant to start with the good news, and this whole audit actually is a good news audit, because we finished this audit back in December and have been working with the program management team who actually put out a policy and a procedure that's very restrictive and does encourage competition last year back in October 2011. It was outside the testing period, but we feel that this is a good basis for moving forward. And since we came out with the audit findings, Build LACCD has updated the procedure and policy, and they plan and they approved their entire Touchpoint handbook, including this procedure, back in March of this year. And plan to do training now and push down the restrictions to have a competitive process for all professional services contracts moving forward. So that's the good news, is that we together are going to move forward with a procedure that would encourage.
Is there a date?
Sorry?
Is there a date by which they will
The training starts in June?
Not the training.
The procedure?
No, but let me just finish the sentence. Is there a date in place by which you will go to 100% competition as you implied. You're moving in that direction. I just want to know if there was a date, like within a year or something like that.
The 100%
Okay, so the procedure's actually out now and has been released to the CPM, correct?
Next month, we'll start moving the road shows and be released.
Okay. I'm going beyond the procedure.
Well, that's the procedure they need to follow.
They do need to follow it effective.
And it says 100%.
Yes.
And so you'll be auditing that up?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, and it's based on a dollar amount. So anything over the dollar amount that, what's the dollar amount, $81,000? Anything over $81,000 must be competed for. So that's the good news. Additionally, they will start using the new conflict of interest confidentiality form as part of whoever is on the selection panel will fill out the form and report any conflicts of interest they have when they review any proposals. We also recommended that the board, the information that goes to the board includes now the three firms that were reviewed and any justification for the award that will go on the PBA that goes to the board for the award. Currently, that information is not always on there, and I know several board members have asked, well, here's the award, but who else did this go to, or who else was looked at? And I think it's important that the board has transparency to see the entire process. And so that's also in place. And lastly, we required, and the district has responded, that they agree that all the contractual documents need to be scanned in within 60 days of the award so that we can, if there's another audit, we can follow up, we can ensure that the documents are there.
I didn't recognize the term used. You mean executed?
Yes, the executed contract.
Will be within 60 days of receipt?
Yes. That the documents related to the procurement get scanned into the document control system.
Okay.
So then when future audits happen, or we can then find the documents. Yes, Richard.
Where did the $81,000 limitation come from?
That's the government. It's a statutory government code requirement for.
Yeah, it escalates every year. Yeah. It's currently $81,000.
So it's statutory state requirement for all districts.
Yes.
It's not related to the size of the district's budget or construction budget. Okay. I have something else I want to talk about.
You're still continuing.
Not this subject.
That's the overview on that. So if you have any questions, I can answer.
So overall, the process has functioned well, but we don't have complete documentation to verify.
I think this is an important audit. I think we actually all welcome this audit, if I can speak for Bill, because there's been such an inconsistency with the nine campuses. This is a way to have that consistency now and everybody be on the same page in how we award these contracts.
But it's more than consistency. It's good practice to put in place. It's $81,000 mandatory requirement for competition.
Yes.
Any other good practices you put in place?
What I'm going to actually, I'll segue into a report that we're developing that we will bring to you at your next meeting is a summary of all the recommendations that we have made from the inception of the Office of the Inspector General through current, so that we can give you a status on how many of our recommendations have been executed and what the status is. I think we're working on the document now, and it actually, you will be able to see the number of improvements, I think, that the program has taken on, the number of policies and procedures that have been developed, and good practices that are in place now. I think it's an important report, and I think Ms. Fields will concur. I think the board will welcome it.
Can't wait. It's nice to feel like you're justified, right?
Had on your agenda any thought of doing an audit of the comparison for design-build contracts and design-bid-build contracts based on cost per square foot, completion schedules met, change orders, extras, percentages as compared to industry standards, satisfaction with construction quality?
Let me give you an update. I think those are all very important things. We have not had an opportunity, we have not put forth our annual plan for year two to the board yet. It's been ready since January. We have, so in other words, we don't have an approved plan moving forward into year two. What's on the current annual work plan are seven audits, one of them being a comparison of change orders for two change order audits, one specifically looking at design build contracts and design bid build contracts to see if what the analysis is. There's two change order audits that I just went ahead and started because I feel that they're valuable and we want to look at our current policy to see if it's serving us and to see if we are getting the best value. And to look at change orders because to me they're one of the highest risks this program has to see what controls we need to put in place. I want to take the annual report to the board and bring it here to the committee because I would like your feedback to see if that's something that we can do.
Well, let me give you some feedback for another industry since you asked for it. Change order counts per se don't mean anything. In other words, if you were to find that this project has twice as many change orders as the next one, that is not necessarily good or bad. You have to look into the nature of the change orders, why they are being changed, in order to evaluate that. So it requires a depth look, in-depth look.
Yes, and one of the specific areas that we are looking at is the source of the change orders, the source of the scopes of change.
Well, don't you have a change management board? And if anybody wants to make a change, isn't there a proposal that has to be put to that board and evaluated?
No.
So I see a head shaking over there.
Ooh. No, there are more controls in place in the last 18 months to track change orders that the program manager is doing.
Okay.
But I don't know
how does a change get accepted? Suppose I work for one of these firms. And I say, I think, you know, you've told me to do this with this concrete, and I don't think it's the right concrete, I've got to change it. How does somebody say yes or no to that? It's not in the current contract.
For the most part, depending on unless it's a very high dollar value, the recommendation and the process is done at each campus by the CPM firms. In other words, they're recommending for approval.
Nobody approves or disapproves of it?
It comes down here.
It
does.
So at the college, they have authority to go up to 3% without getting the
cumulative
next
level. Or individually? Cumulative.
Without getting the next level involved. You know, the next level is 5%, and that's the program team. And then 10%, it comes to the district. And then above 10%, you know, we have to go through the board process.
Okay.
So the reality is when the board approves, and this is on design bid build. Okay, on design, bid, build, you know, as we go through that process, we have to follow the statute because it says nothing over 10%. Now, just a caveat to this, there is a recent court ruling that we're looking into right now that says basically that you should not count unforeseen conditions and errors and omissions as part of that 10%, that should be paid separately. So we're looking at that from a legal perspective right now to see if that will have an effect on how we manage as a district. But one of the things you get into, if you get into a lot of these old buildings, you can eat up to 10% really quick with unforeseen conditions because it wasn't on there weren't any as-builts, it wasn't on the plans. You know, so those are things that we're talking about right now. You know, and I know LAUSD on like renovations has the ability to go up to 25% change orders on renovations. We don't have that as Community College District. We can only go up to the 10%. So, and that's one of the things that the Building Program Review Panel weighed in on. So they did say that we should review the change order process and how we're managing that.
What are they going to call those kinds of expenses if they're not change orders or unforeseen conditions?
The court case said that they could be paid as a claim.
Okay, so they'd be claimed. So they'd still be available for review as a separate part of the overall contract cost.
We haven't made any recommendations to the board on that yet, but this recent court case has you know, some implications on our processes. So we've been talking about it with our legal team right now.
Again, I didn't catch one part of that you said, if I didn't catch it. The 3% level is 5% at the campus.
And 5% goes to the program management team. 3% is at the campus.
Okay.
5% the program management team's involved. 10% the district office is involved.
All changes have to be ratified by the Board of Trustees within 60 days, regardless of the dollar amount.
So even if it's a 1% change, it still comes to the board.
But I imagine it doesn't get the same level of scrutiny. I mean, the scrutiny is as a function of the amount of dollars that are involved, right?
Prior to execution, that's correct. But you know, we've refined the board action, the part of the agenda that addresses change orders, to identify the origin of the change, also whether it's owner-directed, unforeseen conditions, or design package issues, to address the transparency on that.
Okay, thanks.
I still would like to go further. So you're saying that you don't have on your agenda at this time any directive to compare design build to design bid build?
That's correct.
Well, I'd like to make a motion that we suggest that to the Inspector General to place it on the agenda.
On her list.
Harrison.
We've got a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All of those opposed? All those abstaining? Unanimous, I guess. Anyway, I know you get your direction from the board, and you said you wrote your thing in January, so if you could add that to it and ask if they would consider putting it on your mandates, we would appreciate it.
I will do that.
Thank you. You know, you've got a lot on your plate, but every once in a while we're trying to see if it makes some sense to us.
I mean, I'm happy to do that. That's a good one.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions for Christine? All right. Thank you very, very much. Well, we have Chancellor Guerrera today. Deputy Chancellor Guerrera sitting in the seats of the Chancellor. It's your time.
Well, actually, this is going to be very brief because, as you know, we have Jim O'Reilly with us, who is the Executive Director for Facilities Planning and Development. And this the Hill International Report was a contract that the board undertook prior to Mr. O'Reilly's joining us, but he has been engaged, and the board received the report on April the 11th at the board meeting, and it was an assessment of the program management functions leading into the recompete for the program management. So I will now turn it over to Mr. O'Reilly to provide you with a summary of the report. It is attachment C in the information that was mailed to you.
And what I'm going to read from is a brief PowerPoint that Hill provided to the board. I will minimize any of their marketing material that they may have included in this. If you've read the Chancellor's panel report, this does a lot to echo that.
Which one is this?
It looks like but I'm going to read back. I'll be reading from their overview, which is kind of a briefly about Hill, just to give you an idea of why they were contracted with. They're a global program management firm, about approximately 3,200 people. They're a public company with NYSE, and their industry rankings are. They're the first in the independent construction management for fee, first construction claims consulting, and frankly, that's where they've got their start. Hill originally looked at claims, so they're looking at problems on the back end of issues and back ends of programs. But they're also program managers, so they're identifying them at the front end now. But they're top 10 in most of the program management services in the program ranking, so they do have a good insight into this.
Do you need a copy?
Hill conducted an objective study of the current build programs and procedures and in the PM functions. Part of this was to be an assistance in us developing the scope for the next round of program management RFP, which we anticipate going out in the next few months.
Excuse me, so who specifically is full time?
Program management services.
Services.
Yes.
As distinct from program management or including the act of program management? And if it is, go ahead.
Program management is services, and I mean the way I would define it.
Now, program management of what?
Of your program, of the bond program, what URS is currently doing for you.
At the district level, at college level, or at both?
This is going to be for the district level. This is the overall bond program.
Okay.
Just for clarity, this is really the program management service that we call Build LACCD.
That's correct.
Yes.
And the existing functions were compared to the most applicable industry leading standards and what we have available. Basically saying they're looking at the BMPs and what most people are doing in the management of large programs, large capital improvement programs around the world, and more specifically in the United States. They reviewed the existing policies and procedures. They analyzed some of the previous reports that we had out there, and they performed interviews with many of the key staff within the program to determine their findings. They talked a lot about the best practices, many of which we're performing now. Communication management, human resource management, quality management, time management, scope management, governance management, stakeholder management, financial management, integration management, procurement management, risk management are just some of the functions that are associated with the entire program management. And those are the things they looked at. When you get to the meat of the report, they begin talking about the findings. And their findings were that the most of the program management functional areas were addressed.
In the current management scheme?
Yes, in the current management scheme.
But URS is doing now?
That's, yes, sir.
And that they're a permissible bidder on when the RFP goes out?
Hill will not be.
No, URSS.
Yes, they will be. They are the incumbent, and
right.
I anticipate, although I haven't had confirmation, that they will compete again.
I can give you that confirmation.
Okay. I thought you might, John.
Thank you.
One of their findings was the absence of consistency amongst the documents. And I believe this stems from with the changeover that we had in leadership of the program management team, going from Jim, AAA, URS, mostly J. We had two different sets of policies and procedures. If you look at the first policies and procedures Jim created back in the day, and what we're currently using, they don't always meet up. So that was one of their findings. Also, another issue that they brought to light was communication issues sometimes between the program management side and then the CPM side, that being at the district level and in the directives being pushed down to the campus level. And that was another one of their findings. They noted that our program risk management process is needed. While we do have a risk manager, they deal primarily with the OSIP and the insurance part. What the Hill recommendation for was more of an enterprise risk management.
So you look at projects would be included and their performance.
Well, yes, sir. Look at it from an entire overview.
The other functionalities.
Yes.
That you'd be looking at. One of which would be, I guess you might have included that when you discussed the financial. That is. I noticed I'm getting ahead of you here, I don't mean to, but earned value management, for example, was recommended as a best practice, which confuses me because, Tom, we had that meeting where some of your guys were there and they said they use earned value management, so I'm confused about why it's been recommended if it's been used.
I can address what they're used to seeing and what was being presented to them were a little different, but, it was still earned value management. It just wasn't in the format, and they made a comment that the financial system was somewhat complex. So I think part of that going forward, it's a good thing to look at.
Now, in this recommendation, as we're talking about it, I think they specifically recommended they discussed PMI. Did I see that here?
They use PMI as a standard.
Okay, so
as one of for industry best practice.
So the PMI standard for earned value is pretty widely accepted and may be more severe than the one you have been using, but now is it specific the kind of standard they have in mind?
It was a recommendation.
Okay.
Yes. Another finding was...
Let me stop you. Do you need to explain what it is you're asking? Does everybody in...
Earned value management. I can explain it very simply at a top level, but when you get into the details, it's very complicated. But it is a way of asking throughout the enterprise, good term, you know, is what you're doing on schedule, it's accomplishing what it should by a certain point in time, and is it costing more or less than you originally anticipated? And then that feeds into risk management, because if some of that investigation shows that you're spending more than you thought you would spend to achieve something, there has to be a risk management plan linked to that, which says, and here's our mitigation. We're not going to do something, or we're going to do something different.
And to follow on with that, they were looking at, as a standard, you know, a program of this magnitude would typically have some professional risk management involved initially in it to set aside or to look at what we have with regards to contingencies, program reserves, and things like that for what may occur in the past, so that you always have your money set away for a later date.
And I'm sure PMI has a risk management standard as well it recommends.
I would agree.
Okay.
Another noted finding was the perception regarding business ethics. And I think a bit of that has to do with the size of the organization that we have here as the entire district. I hope I'm not misspeaking in my 3 weeks worth of experiences, that we don't have an ethics department, not just for the program, but for the entire district. And something in other large organizations that I've been involved with, and probably many of you, there's typically an ethics office or something that you can defer to or ask questions of.
There is a hotline, though, that Christine installed.
That's a little late. That's oftentimes, I think, once something has occurred. But if you have questions,
I see your point.
Yes, if you have questions of whether is this okay or is this not okay,
you never want to get your questions.
Problem prevented.
I've used it in the past and in my career to ensure on how I'm handling business appropriately. And I think it's important to know that they did put perception in there. That's one of the key words. They mentioned a lack of program quality assurance and quality control. Now, this can be a bit misleading because, of course, we have quality control at the contractor's level on the job sites. And then in addition to that, we have an inspector of record that will assure that we have the quality assurance portion of that to ensure that the general contractor has quality control. But what I believe this is referencing is the quality assurance at the program level, meaning oftentimes you would have an office of quality where we would go and look at the policies and procedures that are in place that are being utilized by both the program management team and the CPM teams at the district level, and going to ensure that we are following our own procedures. That way, Ms. Mraz, when she goes out to look at the job sites, comes back with a sparkling report that nothing has occurred out of the ordinary. And that's something we don't have in place, and that, once again, on a program of this size, you would expect. I'd also go on that this necessarily wouldn't always fall just to the program management team. This is something that, at a district level, should be handled, because obviously we want to look at their policies and procedures and how they're doing it. And so an independent review either by an outside firm or by the district. And they talk a lot about the substantial amount of change to date, and I think we're all aware of that at the personnel levels of consistency, I mean at my position, at the chancellor's position, at college president's positions, that we're losing a lot of institutional knowledge when these things occur. And then not only that, but people's vision change. And we oftentimes, as leaders, have different visions. And that can sometimes be confusing to your organization that you're trying to lead. On to conclusions. And I'll read these right off. The existing program management process appears stable, but realignment with best management practices is recommended. And a lot of what we just talked about in the findings were best management practices, meaning that we need an alteration here and there, but the program is stable. Next bullet is areas of improvement are achievable without incurring significant additional costs, meaning that you don't need a massive change in the organizational structure, you don't need a massive change in the way that you're doing business, but you do need to do some tweaking in order to make the program more effective. Third bullet is the implementation of these recommendations will result in improved program decisions and enhanced benefits to the program.
How is that going to be measured?
I'm sorry?
How will that be measured?
I don't know if you're going to be able to put metrics to these until you determine exactly which BMPs that you want to institute. And then you would put the metrics to those particular things and develop them. It goes back to your QA, QC. How do you figure out if somebody's doing a good job if you don't know what the rules are? Which goes back to the lack of procedures or a consistent standardized procedure.
So in the future, sometime in the future, you will look to see what would be the metrics or something like the metrics to measure within the
Absolutely. Region. I think without metrics, it's very difficult as a leader to make a determination as to how your organization is performing. And that
goes
back.
You bet your goals unless you know what your measurements are.
That's right. That's exactly right. So I think you go back to your quality assurance and quality control, and that's kind of where it's going to start. And that, of course, is integral to the policies and procedures portion of it. The summary of the recommendations were update and simplify existing program management procedures, set up PM-CPM collaborative workshops, which I believe we're already doing, and that's to go to the communication issues that they had mentioned. Assign a program human resource manager. Once I did a little bit of a background checking on that, that went back to what we were talking about with business ethics and having proper and appropriate training up front, you know, and once again, I don't know if this is necessarily the program manager's responsibility. I think this is an institutional responsibility, but that's my humble opinion, of course. Implement program quality assurance, quality control procedures, improve program reporting process, develop a program management process, or a program management risk process. It should be important to note that we have somebody under contract or getting them under contract. We believe they're going to be in May, is their anticipated arrival.
It's next month.
Yeah.
The actual workshops will be in June, but it'll come in May.
And do the evaluation, Sean?
Setting up the, what we need to do is we need to look at.
Yeah, and there's a couple important things that we want them to look at immediately, and I'll get into those a little bit later. Perform cost-benefit analysis on future changes, monitor those impacts, which goes back to what you were talking about. Make small incremental changes rather than major changes infrequently.
Cost-benefit analysis in an academic setting is very difficult frequently, because one of the benefits will be improved teaching methods, or, and that's tough to evaluate, at least in the short term.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and that's an interesting point, I wonder if they're not talking more to the construction portion of it, to the processes.
I generalize, because a lot of things that are done at schools are done because they improve the quality of education, and some of those are difficult to measure, but
and subjective, and right. certainly. So the way ahead is to use the positive equity of the program. The folks here have done a great job up until this point. They continue to do a great job, and to use that equity to move forward. They discussed changing the PM process first, looking at the processes, and then personnel if those processes aren't working. Reestablish accountability through proper lines of authority. That means making everything clear, and we go back to, once again, process and procedure, and making sure that there's clear lines of authority and everybody knows who's in charge of what and who's accountable for what. Adopt a proactive versus reactive management approach. And I once again go back to the QAQC, where we're out there checking and making sure that people are doing the work that they're supposed to be doing, as opposed to reacting to it when Ms. Morez has to come in. And use changes, these are all important, use change sparingly to attain best results with minimal side effects. Once again, that goes back to the consistency portion, where they're saying, let's alter what we have. Let's not throw out everything and try to start over because of this. Quick summary is to consider BMPs to manage large program complex programs. Incorporate change thoughtfully to obtain best results. combine the independent review panel findings, which is the other report that was done in January, the Chancellor's report, with our recommendations for guidance to improve program performance. And if you read the first one, you'll realize that a lot of these echo the same sentiments. And that was it. That was the presentation. You have a longer report. This was the summary that Hill provided. And as I said, I did take out all their marketing material because they provided about four different slides of how they could provide services to us. But, any questions on that?
There are two things that were recommended in the Chancellor's in the report to the Chancellor by the Special Committee that I don't think are being enacted. Okay, one of them, and they really cut to the heart of some of the comments that Nancy made as well earlier, one of them has to do with the constitution of this committee, okay, and the recommendation was it should be smaller and it should contain more construction experts. We don't have many construction experts on the committee. So I want to make you aware of that.
Okay. I'm ill-prepared to address
I wasn't asking
anything comment. Recommendations with the committee.
Has the board reached any conclusions about the independent panel's report?
I do not think so. I think the ad hoc committee has to massage it first.
I was going to try to be at the meeting on Wednesday.
Well, what we are doing in preparation for that or in response to that, Mona, is I think we've come up with some really good ideas. We're putting it together, the motions to bring forward for the board to enact. Mm-hmm. And that should be this week. We'll be working on that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
On the actual language.
Are there any more questions for Mr. O'Reilly?
Welcome aboard.
Yeah, thank you very much. Appreciate it. My pleasure.
Thank you very much. I guess we're still on the agenda to continue.
Okay.
Wait a minute. Dr. Barrera, did you have some more?
Nope. That was it.
Thank you for being here. I know you come every time, but now you have two hats on today. I appreciate it. Okay, program update then is the next thing on our agenda.
And I'm going to program update. First, we're going to start off with a moratorium update. I'm going to give you a brief in general where we are on that. And if we want to get ultra technical, I'm going to put the panel of experts over to the right, John. I'm going to answer any of the questions that go more into specifics. Briefly, we've been working on releasing projects. Where we are currently is releasing projects that did not add square foot, or did not add additional square feet, and essentially will not incur any additional maintenance and operation expenses. We're looking forward to making sure that we don't charge the district build anything that we can't maintain. To this point, we've released approximately $200 million earlier in the spring, and by the end of this month, we were hoping to release another $400 million that meet all those criteria. Now, in addition to that, we're running a parallel track of going back into what we call a fusion database, which essentially, can you explain the fusion database at the state level? Probably better than I can now.
Yeah, so the fusion database is a software program that the state uses that takes a bunch of different metrics and puts them together, and then it gives you information to manage with. So it looks at your square footage, how much square footage you have on the campus. It looks at what your enrollment is. It looks at how much your project costs are. It looks at, projections for 5-year plans. You know, so it takes all those metrics and puts them together. And one of the things that we did is we went out and we took that information because we're projecting where our square footage will be versus where our enrollment is. And, you know, it takes a certain amount of square footage in order to for each student that's in the classroom. So this is a comparative analysis of where we're at in square footage versus the amount of students we have in seats and where we're projecting we will be on the building program based on what the campuses are saying that they're going to build out. So over the past several years, you know, we've done this report to the state, and then we went back and we looked at this compared to where we're at today, given the fact that in 2001, when we started the building program, we were in a growth mode. Every year we were growing enrollment. Mm-hmm. In 2008, you know, when the economy started to turn, our enrollment kind of stagnated and then started to drop. So there's two simple concepts that we've been looking at. You know, one, if the amount of square footage goes up, your cost goes up, you know, in maintaining. You know, and so the question is, you know, if we have increased costs in maintenance and operations of those buildings and utilities and those areas, yeah, how can we continue to afford to pay that when the state's cutting the funding that's coming in? And so that's one simple concept. The other simple concept is as the square footage goes up and our enrollment goes down, why do we need the additional square footage if we already have more than enough square footage to take care of the students that we have? So those are two concepts that we've been working on, trying to go through the moratorium and look at all the stuff in the moratorium and say, okay, what makes sense that we continue to build out? You know, and the things that fall out easily are the things that aren't adding square footage, aren't adding cost, in fact, are reducing cost to the campuses. The other piece that Jim was talking about, the piece that's a little tougher to analyze, and we're working on that, is how does that affect the educational program on the campuses, and where are the people in bungalows yet that we need to get them out of bungalows? You know, what is replacement that needs to take place? So that's the piece that we're sorting through yet. We've released a lot of the easy ones that are not going to add square footage and not going to add cost. So those are the $600 million worth of projects that we're releasing. And we will have about $1 billion worth that we'll be working on analyzing to see how we release those over that period of time.
So those sound like replacements. Not going to add square footage, you're not going to add cost. Cost is being expended now, the same amount will be in the future.
Right.
So it sounds like that's the category of old buildings being replaced by new buildings.
Those are the ones that we have early release on, is what we're calling it.
We identify them as low-hanging fruit, so that we're not going to increase the maintenance costs. And in some cases, we're building more efficient buildings, which hopefully will lower the operating costs in the near future. Just because this part of the moratorium is over, or I don't want to say it's over, but we were going to continue, and we're going to go campus by campus. And where I wanted to go with the fusion data, Tom, was that we had identified, we're realizing this is more important than ever. And we want to go back in and check the accuracy of each of the campuses to rectify any inconsistencies that may exist between what's actually there and what might be in the databases, because those will change the ratios and also determine the strategy of moving forward on how we want to go.
But if this book correctly states it, your estimated completion is equal to your budget, actually a little more than your budget, which if I just read this by itself, it says you're going to release all the dollars.
Yes.
Is that the plan?
The dollars don't have to be released.
Yes.
No. Not necessarily.
No, they don't have to be released because they borrow to get them. You just actually have to borrow. You know, you have the right to borrow. You don't have to exercise the right to
borrow. You haven't issued the bonds, and you wouldn't have to expend them.
That's right.
But is that the case then? You expect that in the end, when all this is done, so through this entire process, that you will expend as much as you have budgeted?
That's correct. Ultimately, the plan is still to finish the program.
So, yeah.
But not necessarily is already currently planned.
There has to be some change in that.
It's like any other large capital program that I've seen or been involved with. When you start the program, it's pedal to the metal and you build because there's so many obvious needs. When you get towards the end of the program, you have to build a little smarter. And by that, I mean you have a finite amount of funds left. And what we're doing currently is going through ensuring that we're doing using them wisely and not incurring any operating costs or to minimize the operating costs down the road.
Okay. On page 6, you have 104 buildings that are sitting in moratorium. I don't know how accurate that is. How many are now sitting in moratorium?
John.
Yes, you did have actually 96 sitting in the moratorium. And for early release, and Jim was just talking about that, and this early release was the end of last week, we released 25 projects. That was 25 projects that Jim was defining as out of the 96. But that's the first phase in our analysis.
So let's go further. So that knocks it down to about 75, something like that. That is still there.
Yeah.
You expect to release most of those 75, given all the considerations we've heard about?
There's a number of issues involved in your question. The first issue is that the program that exists at the moment will expend all of the money, and that's what you would expect. In addition to that, it's been identified that we need to put a reserve aside. And you know that, and you know that the reserve's been talked at $160 million. That reserve will have to come and be established by, in fact, not building some of the projects that are in that 75.
Right.
So the first part of the answer to your question is no, we will not, in that sense, build all of the projects.
But if you are lucky and skilled enough, okay, you will not need to use the reserve for a large fraction of it.
We go back to what Jim said before. The point of a reserve is, and we are going to do a proper analysis on the reserve to determine from here to the end of the program as to what contingencies we believe that we
and
will
these
need.
Include closeout contingencies.
Exactly. What contingencies we believe we will need. We will also be putting a risk mitigation plan in place, so we don't necessarily blindly incur these risks. We've identified them, and we'll obviously work to mitigate them, if not delete them. But the thing is, I can't sit here, Jim can't sit here, and say to you, we won't use that 160.
Well, I saw some discussion to the effect that you will put in a 10% reserve because that's considered prudent.
No, that
then
isn't.
Then I misread something.
Well, I'll tell you how the 160 million was determined. We did sit down and do a desktop risk analysis. So it wasn't just a figure out of the air. But I've been involved in many risk analyses. I was responsible for the ones in Australia for the Olympics. I've done it on airports in billion-dollar programs. So I've got a lot of experience in. I certainly wouldn't run it. We've got experts coming to run this analysis. We have got the 160 million. We will do a full analysis. And that will confirm at what level of probability that 160 will sit at.
Understand.
You understand what I'm saying? We might have a 90% to come in under a chance of coming in the 160.
What?
We might have 50. So there's a lot. You've asked good questions, but there isn't a tried answer to it.
And that's fine. I have no objection. I have one more question, though, on the subject, and that is, at one point in time would you have completed your risk analysis to the extent you can offer an opinion as to how much of that 160 million, which is put aside at this time, which is 2.5%, I guess, of the project, you will need?
Okay. We're planning on the gentleman and the people coming down in May, and we'll be informing them. We're planning at this stage on having workshops in mid-June. After those workshops, we will need to run computer analyses. And I would say to you, early July, we will have. Please bear in mind, we're putting the plan in.
And I understand this is an estimate, and it may take longer. I just want to get a sense of it.
That's just giving you a...
So at the August meeting or whatnot, or sometime in there, we'll have some idea of what's up.
Sometime in early July.
Yeah, but we don't meet again until August.
And prior to that, yes. there will be board action to put aside the 160 million.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's prudent to note that there's a very good chance that after this risk analysis is done, that they may come back and say that you should probably have more set aside.
Yeah.
now, but I think we're comfortable with the 160 million.
Is there a formula for determining what would be each college's contribution to that? Because that's one of the very hot items that some feel they've been careful use of their funds and others have not, and some have overbuilt and some have not and whatnot. So is there some type of tricky formula the board is going to
it's already been set aside actually for each campus on what their portion would be, and unfortunately I don't have that piece of paper in front of me right now, but it has been shared with all the college presidents, faculty, etc.
That's right, and we've given them that, and then
so
coming out there,
they
know what's expected relative to 160.
That's correct.
The other question is you were reporting on. College enrollments are very much affected by economy, loans available, all kinds of things. When the number of classes offered has to be decreased because there's less money available to hire faculty or put, and like almost all of the schools are not doing any summer. That's a large loss of students. As far as student, and that determines how much we get.
Repeatability.
So it's like you've got a moving target to try to determine what is a realistic estimation of what is going to be needed 20 years from now because of where we are in the economy right now. Anything you can give us that would give some input, but I'm very aware that I think the decrease in enrollment right now, at least my opinion, is that it's a false decrease that is relative to the economy, that it may stay that way for the next 20 years or it may boom up. Yes, your input.
Yeah. In contemplating the moratorium, there are two questions on my mind. When and whether. Right. We have a master plan. Our construction is based on a master plan. I'm really thinking of the district, not just my college. We all have a master plan towards which we're building, and it is based in part on our projected enrollment when this program is completed. So the thinking is by 2015, by 2020, how big is your college in terms of enrollments? Yeah. That brings up the weather question. Should we build more classrooms, or will we have enough classrooms when this program is built, or do we have enough classroom space, lab space, and so on today to satisfy a need?
For 2020.
The when question answers, should we build those classrooms now? Or because we are in fact on a downhill slope for the moment in our enrollment, should we wait to a time when we can project actual need for that space so that in fact we are not paying to maintain facilities when they are known to be unneeded? I can tell you my college doesn't need classrooms today.
Right.
Why would we rush to build classroom space today when we might need it later? Right. Now, there's still an argument, and many colleges will tell you, there's still an argument about how much space we actually need for classrooms. That's the detailed analysis that needs to be done. But today, we shouldn't be building. In the future, we should be building. I'm talking only about classroom space. Our bond programs are very complex, and they have many, many issues, including infrastructure, including office spaces, including energy projects. There are many, many things that make up a college in addition to classroom.
True.
And so we can, in fact, shuffle our projects around so that we build the things today that are needed today, and if classroom space will be needed in the future to meet our target enrollments, then we could look back at the
point about building dual mode buildings that could be converted easily if the need arises from one side to the other.
It's something we're looking at in the flexibility of the learning environment, and it's something we've seen in other places. If you become too specific on one concept, the building can be inadequate 5 years from now if they want to change the building concept. So it's something that our designers do look at when they're designing the structures, is to look at the flexibility of the use.
And we're assuming that brick and mortar is what is going to be needed for the future for education versus technology, which does not require brick and mortar and some other things, although I have difficulty understanding how you can do physiology without on a computer, but that's just a bias.
I think it should be noted that this president, for instance, has done a fabulous job of taking the time in the moratorium that the moratorium has given us, and he's looked at the campus, thought about it strategically, determined where the money is best spent, and I think it's really, I mean, you should be commended for the work that you've done. Some presidents felt the need to just stick with the master plan that they had 5 years ago. Others really went back and put a lot of thought into the strategy and how they were going to finish out their job.
Yes.
Thank you. And, you know, this is such an important discussion. Thank you to all of you here as volunteers. Much appreciated. I just wanted to kind of share some thoughts because this moratorium issue is obviously very complicated and really, you know, has brought out a lot of debate, some of what you're having. You know, what is the future hold? It's, you know, how much state support will we have? What are fees going to be? They're going up already this summer again. What will that do to enrollment? You know, there may be changes in the opportunities for financial aid for students. We're talking in Sacramento about increasing students' success by saying you have to have certain grades to get your grants. My point being, there are enormous questions. The question of online instruction. West has always been ahead of everyone. Lots of what they do doesn't require classroom space. It requires somebody sitting somewhere with a computer and communicating with students all over the world in some cases. So much unknown in terms of how to proceed at this stage. And I do want to tell you that the board saw a very good presentation the other day, which I hope will come here. Tom and Jim and the chancellor and others presented. Again, it's not definitive because none of us know,
but a
good overview of sort of where we stand now in terms of this business of square footage that exists versus what we could theoretically build under the, I'll call the original plan of the bond, our bonds, and sort of some of the data about these tremendous constraints on our ability to maintain those buildings. And I want to just say again, another little piece of this is, you know, some of the criticism of the district bond program, which you're familiar with, around, for example, John Chung's report. I was with a colleague from the board. We went to Sacramento. We met with the staff in his office, and they're one of their biggest points about, you know, where are you heading with this bond, and how will you correct some of the things we criticized, was exactly this issue of, you, in effect, they said, you should not be building what you cannot maintain. And if you don't have operating funds for those future maintenance costs, labor and materials, you know, don't do it. And I mean, they were pretty, I thought, very direct with us. And so that's a variable we have to think about, is external pressures to be fiscally responsible in terms of the long-term costs. And if I may, I wanted to throw in one other piece of it, and I the experts can please correct me if I've misunderstood, because I am still a lay person in regarding construction and these many issues. But in addition to sort of the maintenance and operations, just normal routine, there's something that our district apparently has not done, which is to have deferred maintenance as a regular part of our operating budget. And we've just recently found out, and I think this will, we're going to need to learn more. You know, we've always, pretty much, is my belief and understanding, we've said when money is tight, we'll protect the employees, we'll protect the students, and the buildings, oh well. I mean, to be honest, that's what has happened, I think, over many decades. And of course, we really can't afford not only our older buildings that need maintenance, but even these newer ones are going to need to be kept in good condition. And so that's a whole other element of deferred maintenance, how to find it in our operating budget, because it is not a bond cost, and how to protect, you know, these tremendous investments that the taxpayers are making. So I'm sorry, I'm just kind of throwing in a lot of the variables that the board is going to be looking at, and again, relying heavily on our expert staff to bring us concrete approaches, relying on the campuses to do their share. And I would encourage all of you, particularly those from a campus oversight committee, to be asking at that level, you know, what's been done here to figure out what is essential now, what might be needed 10 years from now. Again, such guesswork about that. You know, try to get a sense of how your campus is preparing for the adjustment in, you know, what we will do now versus what money might be held aside. Because I mentioned what Nancy said earlier. I had asked, can we have unspent money kind of sitting indefinitely before we even borrow? And the answer was, yes, at least for a while. You can have it not, don't go out and borrow the money, don't spend it till you see where the real needs are as best we can predict. But so thank you all for engaging in this and making sure, I'm sure we will continue to hear back from you on what you're finding out.
There's one thing I haven't heard discussed, so I'll just bring up a comment. You probably are way ahead of me on this. But there's the question of construction efficiency. So if you take a posture whereby you put money aside with the thought of enacting it at a future time when things are better known, you also lose the bulk of the capability you have because it's no longer on campus. That is, the construction companies may have to be brought back. And so there are inefficiencies introduced by that process, too. I can't say how severe they are, but I hope somebody at least is looking into that question.
You know, I appreciate your comments, and I have to agree with you on the deferred. I think somehow maintenance has to be a set percentage from this point on. I know at Valley College, before I even got involved with anything, I would walk around there every day. It's part of my walk. And I would see how dirty it was. Mm-hmm. And I'd call up and they'd say, well, we don't have enough staff to keep it clean. Mm-hmm. Well, that was silly because the whole place looked dirty. But one thing about being older, one of the benefits of being older is you have history behind you. I have seen this country go through recessions. Others here have too. Bad recessions. I remember 91 was the worst ever. It was the Great Depression back, Great Recession back then. Before that, we had another one. When I was a kid, recessions seemed to happen every 3 years, and they only lasted 6 months. As I get older, they happen more infrequently, but they happen longer. Now, the point I'm trying to get at is, we will come out of this, and we will probably be out of this in 5-6 years, and everyone will be forgetting what happened now, forgetting what went on now. I remember the 91 recession. By the time we hit 2001, everything was hopping and booming, left, right, and center. Housing prices and building prices just soared. I think we have to keep that in mind as you plan what you want to do. I think we have to be optimistic. I'm not saying unduly optimistic. I think we have to use history as our gauge. We will come out of this in a couple of years. And then you're going to have kids clamoring to go to these schools. And then we may not have the classrooms. Then we're going to start building the classrooms, but they won't get built in time. I think we have to sort of hedge our bets with a historical optimism as our guide and not just pull back and say, oh, no, we're going to build as we have to, because then we're going to undercut. When we do build, the cost will soar. We won't be able to get as much for the buck. And right now, if you do start building, how many years is it going to be before they're built? It's going to be a couple of years. By that time, I assure you, we probably will be out of this, or certainly well on our way out of this. Recessions don't last forever, and especially in this country, they don't. So I urge we keep that historical optimism as our guide.
The other thing is that our colleges aren't necessarily for young people. Our colleges have a very wide breadth of population. Let me have you speak first, then, Jim.
I just wanted to add that it's not that we haven't added square footage, because our enrollment has gone down, but we've increased our square footage over a couple million square feet, you know, from going from 5 million square feet. Our projection was finishing at around 8.8 million square feet. We're halfway in between there, so we've added a lot of square footage, but our enrollment hasn't gone up, it's gone down. So the reality is we are, our building program is outpacing our budget. You know, so that's the issue that we're dealing with, is we keep building, but our budget keeps going this way. And we have additional square footage already at the campuses that is showing that we are overbuilt at a lot of the campuses. And that's the data that we're going back and reviewing to make sure that we've got those numbers right. And as we move forward, but it's showing that we have more square footage than what we need right now, quite a bit more square footage. In some cases, over 200% more than what we need. So it's not like we aren't planning for the future. It's just that we've got to take a serious look at where we're at today versus where we're going to be at down the road, and trying to make sure that we gauge that and we don't outpace our
budget. Keep in mind, down the road is going to come quicker than you think.
Especially at
our age.
Well,
we're also, there's a parallel exercise going on right now, and we'll be meeting with the college presidents, myself, and smart facilities people to see what going forward makes sense right now. Meaning we may be liberalizing some of the policies with respect to the additional square footages and some of the buildings that are most needed. For instance, when I was at West today, and I was at Valley yesterday, and I saw some work that just needs to be done. And we have to figure out a way to do that.
Yeah, and don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to say that we need to go rush and build everything as planned. I'm just trying to say I think we need to move away from this, I think, this pessimism we have, and start understanding this is a temporary hiccup in the economy that may, temporary may be a little longer, but it will change, and we need to have that in our mind.
Richard?
Was there someone else that?
Oh, Jane and
I have a couple of questions. How do we calculate projection numbers of enrollment? Like, because that's a very complicated.
You throw darts at it.
I don't know.
Because how
yes,
would you?
There is some calculation of the population in the area around.
Yeah,
what's your service area? What's the age of the population there? What's the average popular age of the people coming into there? What programs are needed in your area to supply workers?
Blah, blah, blah.
What skill sets are they going to need to meet the needs of that community? I mean, there's a lot of figures that go into it, but you're still
guessing.
I mean, you know, it's good guessing, but there's not a, somebody's not going to come up with
an educated guess is better than.
Has anyone ever measured projections in the past and seen how they actually fit it into the reality?
Projecting 25 years in the future is likely to be wrong.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. And the other thing, too, is, as you noted earlier, that our age groups of students are not the typical traditional age students of 18 to 24 moving on. They're a varied age range. I have
from
a
13
student,
to 60 to 75.
Yeah. There's a 70-year-old that's in one of my classes. And
yeah, we're nice people.
Yeah, well. But the problem is with the current direction of the state on making our community colleges more like junior colleges rather than community colleges, they're really focusing on the traditional students to try and push them through to go through a junior college or community college into a four-year university. And the older generations are kind of left behind because the older students are there just for personal enrichment rather than just trying to get a degree, because they probably already have a degree. They're just going there for the extra knowledge. And the state's moving away from that. And so that could really affect how we use our buildings and how our enrollment is going to be calculated in the future. And so, like, I'm torn between being liberal enough of having enough classrooms, but also being conservative enough going, well, I don't want to see empty classrooms, because when I go down a mall strip and I just see empty office spaces, it looks problematic to me, because it seems, from a student's perspective, that the college isn't doing enough to service us as students. Because if I see empty classrooms, yet I know of a way that we could utilize that space, and the college isn't doing that, it looks bad on the college. So there is a tricky balance between being conservative enough on making sure you don't overspend or overbuild, but also enough for the future. Because I agree with you, there's optimism. You know, things get better. The problem that I'm seeing, though, as well, is workload reductions for faculty also plays a big factor, because if our enrollment...
That's not ours to do with.
I know, but it eventually does come into play on how many classrooms you have, because you have to equate it how many faculty you have. If you don't have enough faculty for all the classrooms, that's why your classrooms go empty.
Isn't there a minimum standard, teaching standard, so many classes per year?
It's variable according to the discipline.
Yep.
Okay, but within any one discipline, isn't there a standard? There are universities.
There's a large variety to consider being a full-time or not, but it's also variable according to the discipline.
I think Dale is saying, like, how many you have to offer of a particular person. No.
On an individual instructor at universities. Okay, you have to teach a minimum of so many or a combination of research and classes. Isn't there that sort of
thing?
There
is, but it's variable by discipline.
Yes, it's variable by discipline in universities too. But is there a standard by discipline?
Yes, by contract. It's in the contract. It's 2:05, and I know there's a lot to speak, so maybe Dr. Brewer, do you want to make your comment?
No, I was just going to say to Jayden that, and just to make a general comment, that we project next year's enrollment based on our funding.
That's right.
So we always, whether the state gives us growth money or, as in the case of the past 2 years.
Your inherent assumption is if it's funded, students will come and people will be paid.
They have.
We're turning away a lot of students right now.
And this district has a history of serving more students than we're funded for. We have a very large unfunded student population. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay.
Well, just on that subject, I mean, the bond program, I'm sure, made a much longer projection of the need for classrooms than just on the annual budget of the district, because the district was far behind in its needs at the time that the bonds were undertaken, as was the Los Angeles Unified School District. Just a side note to that, the Los Angeles Unified School District, when it passed its first bond, had a $30 billion deferred maintenance budget, $30 billion.
Wow.
When I left that committee a year ago, the projection for the deferred maintenance budget was $30 billion after spending something like 17 to 20 billion of the 26 or 7 that they have already. So they were trying to catch up, and I'm afraid budgets and economies didn't allow it. The district surely, through the chancellor's office, must be getting some long-term projections for, because you have those available for economic projections on what's going to happen. The growth per year, the Los Angeles Economic Council does projections like that, that you can base those kinds of projections and use them to make determinations on what the need is going to be for educational purposes, for jobs in the future, and what have you.
And our master plans were initially based on, our master plans, the very beginning of Prop A, were based on the long-term projections, as well as the past need. And so as the master plans have been updated, those projections have also been updated.
One other factor that you were talking about, Elliot, the cost projections that are necessary to make good decisions on when you build and what have you. The other thing you have to determine, if the economy turns around,
well, that's part of it,
when it turns around, the costs start going up as well. So there's a, but you want to catch those just before the costs
are going
up.
That's the idea, anyway.
All the planning you're doing. Suppose you build a building. Hypothetical question. You build a building, and through nobody's fault, but, you know, acts they couldn't control, you can't populate that building. So I assume under those conditions you seal the building, and now I get to my question. What is the cost of maintaining a sealed building? The point I'm getting at is, if the costs of maintaining a sealed building are very low, that would bias one more towards the direction of building them, even if you're uncertain that they will be filled.
I think your question's one.
Not recklessly, by the way.
Right, one of mall quality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What we see our federal government do, for instance, with on-use bases or certain things like that. And to be honest, sir, I can't give you a firm answer because I don't know. That's a research project I'm working on currently, because that's a good question.
I'm glad you're working on it.
Yes. No, that's something I'm looking at right now.
It's about 2:52, which is our closing time. Either we're going to close at 2, or I need a motion for an extension of 10 minutes.
I move to extend time by 10 minutes.
Second. There's a motion. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
What's more important, all those opposed? All right, we'll have until 10 after 2.
Continuing on the same subject of funding, in the monthly progress report on page 3 and 4, you have the total
current funding, which is the total of the bond program, is $6,257,000,000. And you have contracted. Contracted, I take it, would mean that the district is already encumbered for those costs because they are projects that are under construction or completed that still need final payment to be made, but it's contracted already. So if you take that from the total bond program, it was $1,662,000,000 that are still left for projects in the future. Right. Of that $1.6 billion, do we know how much in bonds have been sold?
I don't know the answer.
We still have about 1.8 something bonds left to sell. So we still have, and I know Jeanette had reported at the board meeting it was 2.4, but she came back and said that it was 1.8, between 1.8 and 1.9 was the number when she went back and looked it up.
So even though...
So that we haven't sold yet, so...
So if the decision was to hold back on some of the projects that are in moratorium and in the future, not to build others that are still on the construction list, then the district wouldn't have to sell the bonds to...
They don't have to sell the bonds. Once you sell the bonds, you have 3 years to use them. Mm-hmm. Or you end up paying...
Hold the money. Right?
You end up paying... It becomes a tax thing. You know, you got to pay the arbitrage.
Of the 200 and subsequent 400 projects we talked about earlier, okay, what is their cost? And I'm thinking relative to the 1.6. How much have you, in effect, committed on when you're moving ahead with 200 projects that would use up some of that 1.6 or 1.8? And if the next 400 are approved, how many, what would that cost to get against the reserves we have by not spending funds?
I'm not sure I quite understand your question.
Does the cost of the 200 projects that you're now moving forward on, okay, does that eat into the bonds that have not yet been sold, the reserve in effect that you have of 1.8 billion? How much is that going to cost?
So we have in the moratorium, by the time we release these projects in April that we're releasing, we'll have about $1.3 billion left in the moratorium.
The 200 and the 400 or just the 200?
That'll be the
200 and the 400.
So that's,
so we'll have about 1.3 left. So we'll have to probably sell some more bonds to cover that additional gap there.
So there isn't going to be that much left over when you finish the expected construction. Yes,
it will be 1.2.
Well, we have about 1.1, 1.2, right in there, 1.3, somewhere in that range, depending on how many projects come off right away. But then we'll continue to look at those projects and see, you know, we're visiting the campuses now. You know, so we need to look and see what's needed on the campuses. You know, so we'll continue to work on that list, but we still have to have a reserve there at the end.
But the 200 are not included in the contracted project.
I think John said that there would be 75 left.
Yeah, I mean that's right. There's in
75 still more.
It's not that sort of simple because with, let's say, the 25, we have got some contracts in place for them, like design contracts and the like. But the major construction contracts, where most of the money is, no, that they're not in that figure at this point.
Okay. We interrupted you.
Oh, I don't remember where I was.
Can I just say something?
Sure.
We did hand these out to you previously, and you found them generally found them helpful. And this is the report that tells you by college, by project, how much has been spent. You know, it answers a lot of the questions, in fact. you've been talking about, and we give you a schedule there. So you have had them, if you like.
But what you don't have.
Let him finish his question.
Let me finish. They're there. And what we're also going to hand out to you is a list of all the projects that were initially in the moratorium, and we're giving you a list of the projects that were initially released, and that was 183 million, that was back in January, and we're giving you a list of the projects that have been in this early release, which is the 25 I talked to you about. So if you sort of take that information and the information that's on there, it really gives you a very cohesive overview of the whole financial and scheduling situation.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
I'm sorry for butting in, but I felt like
you needed to come out. Thank you very much.
Would you like to pass it around, or I leave it on the table and you pick it up as you go? How would you like to pass it around? Right on. There's that light.
Anything else on your report?
And Todd's going to
I would like you guys to look at this.
We did have the other attachment there that you wanted to hand out.
Thanks.
Testing your reflexes.
Okay, let me get a recommendation.
I'm going to see if I can jam pack everything.
Okay, so his comment is the building permit review board's recommendation. You should have got a copy.
It should be in the package. It has red letter. It's a response to many of the building program review panels and what we've been doing on the ad hoc and some of the progress we've made to this point and what we're going to be going forward with the board. I think some of the important things to put in here that we've talked about most recently to address some of those things that were in the report was the deferred maintenance that we discussed earlier. We also talked about the program reserve, which will be moving forward. And what else? What am I missing? The use of the satellite money to shore up some of the deficit that we currently have.
Can I ask a question about this?
Sure.
Okay, we got three documents here. I got the final expanded moratorium list, February 16th.
That was all the projects that were initially on the moratorium.
Then I got the February 20th. Yeah, these are the ones that are exempted as of that date.
Correct. You are right.
And then I have this one in April.
The one that we've just taken off. Now, that one in April has got the colleges were asked to submit to us back in February by the 24th of March, the projects they wanted off the moratorium. That all of the projects are there. We're listing as to whether they were taken off or they still remain on for further review.
So basically what I'm asking you is all the projects listed on your February 16th moratorium are on this, and all the projects that were released, exempted from the final expanded moratorium are on this too.
They're not all on there because that list in your right hand was the list that the college said, these are what we want you to consider. All colleges didn't provide all of the projects that were on the original moratorium. Okay. Not to say they won't consider them, but they didn't ask us to consider them. So you won't see it's one for one in your paper. But it's pretty close.
Okay, we've got about a minute left. College reports is going to make a comment on them.
Okay, so in your package you saw a couple of the college reports that have come out. We're still in the process of working with the CPMs to make sure this gets reported correctly. But you can see we're starting to make progress on that. So that follows the format that you have suggested that we use. And we still haven't gone through the entire cycle yet. It looked like this, these reports. But each of the colleges, we've got to get that cycle going, but we've started that process. I'm going to go back and meet with the CPMs and tell them, if you haven't turned them in, I still need them. So get that process going so you'll have those updates.
Yeah, I would think that from my college, yes. I sent emails and whatnot, and I still have them.
Okay.
If there is no other business.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
See you at the end of June.
Thank you.
Did you get your accreditation?
Oh, you have it.